40, and Sunday, mostly sunny.
There are not a lot of silver linings in the report. We are losing engines of job growth.
The labor market has shown little growth since April. What's behind those losses?
For Friday, September 5th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. This hour, how small businesses like Etsy sellers are being hit hard by the end of the de minimis rule.
We still want to sell to you. We may not be able to do it right now very easily, but we are trying.
Also, Indiana Fever star Caitlin Clark won't return for the rest of the WNBA season.
And we will hit up the club, and by the club, I mean the coffee bar, where morning and noontime dance parties are the latest fad.
I think it's a familiar sense of a little cafecito, a little bit of music, and a lot of celebration and good times.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. Federal immigration officials say agents detained hundreds of South Koreans during a sweeping raid at a Hyundai electric vehicle plant near Savannah. Sam Greenglass of member station WABE reports the raid is putting some top Georgia Republicans in an awkward spot.
Republican Governor Brian Kemp has pledged to make Georgia the electric mobility capital of the world, helping woo manufacturers of EVs and batteries with generous state incentives. The Hyundai plant is the largest economic development project in state history, with the South Korean company investing billions. A spokesperson for the governor said the Georgia Department of Public Safety provided support to ICE and, quote, all companies operating within the state must follow the laws of Georgia and our nation. The chair of the Democratic Party of Georgia called the arrests of some 475 people, quote, political grandstanding at the cost of Georgia families, businesses, and livelihoods. For NPR News, I'm Sam Greenglass in Atlanta.
Some employees at the Labor Department are trying to reassure the public that the jobs numbers published by the government can be trusted. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports their statement comes as the latest employment report shows job growth slowed significantly over the summer.
The statement was written by a group of current employees at the Bureau of Labor Statistics in response to recent attacks on the integrity of the Bureau's work. NPR agreed not to name the employees because they fear reprisal for speaking out. Their statement comes a month after President Trump fired the BLS commissioner after the July jobs report revealed a weakening labor market. Trump claimed without evidence that the numbers were rigged to make him and Republicans look bad. The employees say commissioners don't cook the numbers. In fact, they don't even see the numbers until after the estimates are complete. With methods that are public, vetted, and transparent, they write, the public doesn't have to guess whether the numbers are real. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The Trump administration says it will drop a Biden-era rule intended to compensate air travelers when flight disruptions are caused by the airlines. NPR's Joel Rose explains.
The proposal from the Department of Transportation under then-President Biden would have required airlines to pay between $200 and $775, along with free meals, lodging, and rebookings. It would have applied when domestic flights are disrupted by circumstances under the airline's control, including mechanical problems and system outages. The airline industry sharply criticized the proposal, arguing it would drive up operating costs. An industry trade group welcomed the Trump administration's move to drop it. Similar protections for airline passengers have long been in place in Europe and elsewhere. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street lower by the closing bell. The Dow down 220 points, NASDAQ down 7, S&P 500 down 20. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The World Health Organization says Mpox, which was previously known as monkeypox, is no longer an international public health emergency. This as the number of cases fall in the hardest hit countries in Africa. But a continental emergency over Mpox still remains in Africa. In Canada, Etsy sellers and other small online retailers are scrambling to adjust to new U.S. import rules that took effect last week. NPR's Bill Chappell has more.
Like many international Etsy sellers, Cindy Baldassi relies on U.S. customers. She sells jewelry she makes in Calgary, Alberta.
The United States has been one of the easiest places to sell to.
Until recently, the U.S. had low tariffs, and under the U.S. de minimis rule, lower value imports were duty-free. Then President Trump raised tariffs and ended de minimis for all imports, saying the rules were being abused. As a result, Baldassi says,
is going to mean some businesses will end and some who think that they're going to be fine may not be as fine as they hope.
She says Etsy sellers outside the U.S. are trying to adjust to the new rules and costs, but it will take time. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
Mortgage rates fell today to their lowest level in more than a year. Mortgage buyer Freddie Mac says the average rate on a 30-year fixed-rate note is now 6.29%, a drop of 16 basis points. This as the monthly August jobs report showed fewer jobs than expected were created. And Wall Street was lower by the closing bell. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered this Friday afternoon here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering music lessons and art programming for all ages. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE-KBXE news team. Now back to All Things Considered.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. The U.S. jobs engine is sputtering, and it looks to be in danger of stalling out. Today, the Labor Department said employers added just 22,000 jobs in August, and updated figures show the economy actually lost jobs in June for the first time since the pandemic winter of 2020. NPR's Scott Horsley is here in the studio to tell us more. Hi.
Hi, Juana.
So, Scott, the headline from today's report is clearly not what people were hoping for, but the details, are they any better? Any bright spots?
Not really. We've now had 4 months in a row with pretty anemic job growth. Compared to the same time last year, hiring has slowed by about 75%. And economist Julia Coronado, who's with Macro Policy Perspectives, says the weakness is really visible all across the economy.
There are not a lot of silver linings in the report. We are losing engines of job growth.
In August, we saw a net loss of jobs in manufacturing, construction, and oil drilling, all industries that the Trump administration is trying to promote. Even in healthcare, which is one of the few sectors that's still adding a lot of jobs, hiring is slower now than it was a few months ago. You'll remember the jobs report we got a month ago was so bad the president fired the Labor Department official who oversees these numbers. Today's report suggests that that weakness was not a one-off. The cracks in the labor market are still growing.
So, Scott, if you can, help us understand what is behind the job losses that we see in this report.
Yeah, good question. Is this just a natural slowdown that one would expect to see as a job market loses steam, or are we running into speed bumps? Coronado says it looks like at least some of this is speed bumps. You know, she says some of the slowdown appears to be fallout from deliberate policy choices made by the administration.
Job losses in construction reflect a lack of availability of workers due to restrictive immigration policies. The manufacturing sector has been shedding jobs for months, in part because of the trade war.
Now, Trump, on the other hand, argues the real problem is high interest rates, which do act as a brake on the economy. Trump said in a social media post the Federal Reserve should have lowered rates a long time ago. Of course, interest rates are the same now as they were back in January. And in January, the U.S. economy added more than four times as many jobs.
Is the Fed likely to lower interest rates anytime soon?
Yes. Forecasters were already betting that Fed policymakers would cut interest rates by at least a quarter percentage point at their next meeting, which is in less than 2 weeks, to prop up the job market. After today's report, some investors think the Fed could even go further and order a supersized half-point rate cut. However, Coronado says the central bank is really in a tricky spot here because it also has to keep an eye on prices.
The challenge for the Fed is that we're also looking at rising inflation. Next week, the Fed gets another inflation report, and economists don't expect it to look good.
The reason the Fed has been keeping interest rates this high for this long is to fight inflation. And so long as the job market was holding up, you know, policymakers felt like they could take their time before making a change. Now, with these cracks appearing in the job market, the Fed is being pulled in two different directions, and that's not a comfortable place for the central bank to be.
Last thing, Scott, the unemployment rate, it's still pretty low. So how does that factor into all of this?
Yeah, unemployment is still pretty low, just 4.3% in August. We did see a jump, however, in the African-American unemployment rate. That's up to now 7.5%. Some of that is tied to job losses in the federal government. Another thing to keep an eye on, for people who are out of work, it's taking longer now to find new jobs. There are almost 2 million people who've been unemployed for 6 months or more. There just aren't as many job openings as there used to be. You know, for the last few years, we've been in this positive cycle where we had strong job gains, so wages were going up, so people had more money to spend, and that in turn encouraged businesses to hire more people. The danger now is we fall into the opposite cycle where job growth stalls, people get nervous, cut back on spending, and employers then decide they don't need as many workers and start handing out pink slips. Today's report doesn't look that bad, but that is the downward spiral we very much want to avoid.
NPR Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
It is the beginning of the school year, and in 2025, schools are right in the middle of the contentious politics of the moment. President Trump came into office promising to do away with the Federal Department of Education. Schools have also become immigration enforcement flashpoints in some places, and the administration is pressuring public schools to halt DEI efforts in both hiring practices and in the classroom. And there's more beyond all of that. We're going to take a few minutes now to talk about K-12 education in the U.S. and what the White House wants to change about it. I am joined by NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Scott.
As well as NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hey, Domenico.
Hey, great to be with you, Scott.
Corey, I want to start with you. Since you cover education, where do we stand with President Trump's promise to shut down the Department of Education?
Yeah, well, since coming into office, he's already cut the department essentially in half. It's got roughly half the staff it had in January. But I think it's worth highlighting here, there's a real contradiction or tension, Scott, between this desire to close the department and what we've also seen the Trump administration do, which is to wield the power of the department in really new and forceful ways.
Right.
And that is largely by using old federal civil rights laws like the Civil Rights Act or Title IX, which prohibits sex discrimination, to threaten schools, school districts, state departments of education that don't embrace Trump's policy priorities. As you said, ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs that the administration argues are discriminatory against white students or Asian American students, or ending protections for transgender students.
You know, and this was a huge culture war issue during the campaign. Even before it, we saw conservative takeovers at school board meetings around the country with what they saw as quote unquote woke education in schools. Some of that resulted in book bans and curriculum changes. So this is really Trump following through and capitalizing on what his base has wanted.
We have really seen Trump pick fights with higher education, right? Taking Ivy League schools like Harvard and Columbia, threatening their federal funding, making them pay fines in many ways. Is this the same approach he's taking at the grade school level?
Yeah, it is. It's just, it's gotten a lot less attention, I think. The Education Department's Office for Civil Rights has been initiating investigations into a bunch of different school districts, including Denver Public Schools, Chicago Public Schools. They tend to be blue state districts. There are five districts in Northern Virginia. And the complaints tend to be around either these districts' embrace of diversity, equity, and inclusion, mm-hmm. which the Trump administration argues violates Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which prohibits discrimination based on race, color, or national origin, or it's around districts' embrace of protections for transgender students, which the administration argues violates Title IX. It is essentially the same playbook. And what we're seeing is really fast-tracked investigations like we've been seeing against Harvard and Columbia. And it's hard to know how this will play out. A judge in the Harvard case has already recently said they went too fast. They didn't actually follow the law.
We've seen the way that these hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal funding being taken away on higher education levels is causing colleges to really shift tunes. What's the best way to think about how much federal funding local school districts get, how big of a problem this is when it is threatened in that way?
So we know that on average, federal funding makes up a small but important piece of school budgets, around 11%. The more important thing to know is that even though that may not seem like a lot of money, in most districts, the bulk of that money really goes to one of two really marginalized student groups. It helps pay for special education for kids with disabilities, and it helps pay for extra supports for kids living in poverty. And we're not just talking about big city schools. We're talking about remote, rural schools in red states. This money is really important. And the administration, just as it has tried to cancel, say, research funding to colleges, it's now using as a threat the potential cancellation of these important dollars to school districts and states.
Domenico, you mentioned this fits in with a pattern that we have discussed a lot with Trump taking aim at cultural institutions in the country. Can you tell me a bit more about how that applies to education here?
Yeah, and look, there are a lot of people, including a lot of teachers, who see this as going backwards on acceptance and tolerance. And schools and classrooms had for a long time been seen as controlled environments where people from different walks of life can come together, they can be civil, despite their backgrounds, race, sexual orientation, whether someone has special needs, what have you. And sometimes that's meant explicit education of acceptance because, as we know, kids aren't always nice, Scott. But conservatives have long chafed at that kind of thing. You saw Montgomery County, Maryland, for example, lose at the Supreme Court for not allowing people to opt their children out of teaching around a book with same-sex parents.
Yeah.
Remember, though, that kind of thing has been controlled at the local, not federal level. The education department has been responsible for things like keeping statistics, doling out funding, as Corey's mentioned, and resolving complaints of discrimination through the Office of Civil Rights. And as Corey said, we've seen a big change in approach there.
So, Corey, the interesting thing is we didn't even get to all of the stuff that Trump is saying he wants to do in changing K-12 education. But this is like the consummate local issue, right? So in the end, how much can the president of the United States drastically change about this over the next few years?
I don't think he's going to have a lot of impact inside the classroom, but I think he's going to make a lot of states and even district superintendents really anxious with these very real threats to really important federal dollars. Just to underscore the point here, the Office for Civil Rights of the Education Department is putting some superintendents and state leaders in places like California, Maine, Illinois, in the difficult position of potentially having to choose between advocating on behalf of one marginalized group, say transgender students, at the risk of losing federal funding that helps them support other marginalized students.
That is NPR education correspondent Corey Turner and NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Thanks to both of you.
Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
To All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Check out KXE.org to find out about all the events going on in Grand Rapids for Riverfest weekend. From First Friday art events and live music, a birthday celebration of Old Central School, a United Way mile and 5K race, after parties, and more. Support for KAXE comes from The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, a two-day gathering of community members with events focused on equity, connection, and community resilience, taking place at the Geechee Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd, September 22nd and 23rd. More info at sewingroom.org. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library welcome author Kerry J. Griffith Monday, September 8th at noon. He'll discuss his book, Rattlesnake Bluff, A Sam Rivers Mystery. You may bring your own lunch or enjoy the light refreshments provided. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. The Pine River Bacchus Community Garden celebrates its 15th season with an open house and community meal Monday, September 8th from 3:30 to 6, with live music, games for kids, and prize drawings, located just west of the football field at Pine River Backus School. Stages of the Range Players hold auditions for the Ice Fishing Play September 8th and 9th from 4:30 to 6:30 at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Virginia. The play was written by Minnesota storyteller Kevin Kling, and performance dates are in November.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsor jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. President Trump's shakeup of the tariff and import system is changing how some big businesses work, but small businesses are also being rattled, small businesses like Etsy sellers. That is because a trade exemption that once allowed people to skip import fees for shipping small items has now expired. NPR's Bill Chappell reports.
Picture yourself running a one-person Etsy shop in Canada. You're selling craft projects online, and the money's decent. But then this year, everything changed.
It's just an absolute nightmare.
That's Doris Kohanek, a woodworker on Etsy. She sells walnut candle holders and housewares at prices from $30 to $150. Many of those sales have been to U.S. customers, thanks in part to a rule called de minimis that waived tariffs and duties on virtually any import valued at under $800.
Until now, the U.S. has essentially been an extension of our domestic market.
But then President Trump ended de minimis exceptions for all shipments into the U.S. So Kohanek's been busy filling out paperwork. She needs to certify her raw materials come from Canada or the U.S. so she can avoid a 35% tariff. This week, Kohanek's shop got certified. But other Canadian Etsy sellers are in limbo.
Some people feel their businesses are over, especially those who are using yarn and fabric, which very little of which is going to be made in Canada or even in the United States.
That's Cindy Baldassi in Calgary, Alberta. She sells jewelry on Etsy. She's adjusting to the new normal.
Even today, I don't know how things are going to go in the next week. It's that upended.
Small international vendors like Baldassi are drawn to the U.S. market because of its large customer base. And until now, tariffs have been low. Then there's de minimis, which had been a draw. Ernie Tedeschi of Yale University's budget lab says the U.S. exception was pretty high at $800. But many countries have similar rules for small imports for practical reasons.
To go through every single parcel that comes in and levy a tax on it, the squeeze isn't worth the juice at some point.
With de minimis gone, small vendors say they're feeling squeezed. But Baldassi says she has a message for America's online shoppers.
We still want to sell to you. We may not be able to do it right now very easily, but we are trying, and we will hope to get back to you soon.
Bill Chappell, NPR News.
WNBA star Caitlin Clark announced this week that she'll be out for the rest of the season. There had been speculation about whether or not she would return to the court after suffering a groin injury back in July. Clark's injury is bad timing for her team, the Indiana Fever, especially with the playoffs starting next week, but what does her absence mean for the league as a whole? The WNBA is coming off of a record-breaking 2024 season, and Clark has been a huge draw for fans. Sabrina Merchant covers women's basketball for The Athletic, and she joins us now. Hey.
Hi there.
So, Sabrina, Caitlin Clark was the 2024 Rookie of the Year. She just brought in so many eyeballs to the game, and it seems like there were just huge expectations for her on the court coming into this season.
Absolutely. Coming off of, as you mentioned, a Rookie of the Year season and also being first-team All-WNBA, so one of the top five players in the league as a rookie, the understanding was that she would get better and that the Indiana Fever would be able to compete for a championship, and that is decidedly not where they stand with a week left in the regular season.
Remind us, what kind of season was Caitlin Clark having before she got injured?
Yeah, so it's kind of hard to say before she got injured because she suffered her first leg injury during the preseason and has sort of been working off of rehab and recovery as she played the 13 games that she managed to during the sophomore season. The Fever did go 8-5 in those 13 games, which is better than the 500 record they managed when she was a rookie. But, you know, Caitlin really struggled shooting from the field. She had this ridiculous 2 of 35 shooting on three-pointers away from home this season, which is kind of hard to fathom for someone who you associate with a three-pointer as much as Caitlin Clark. But yeah, her efficiency really struggled this year. considering the high bar that she set as a rookie, it's hard to say that she met those expectations as a sophomore and definitely didn't exceed them the way she did in her first season.
I mean, the WNBA is coming off of this really historic year with so much energy and enthusiasm around it, and Caitlin Clark was just a huge part of that. I remember that teams had to switch arenas to accommodate larger crowds when she'd come into town. So I guess I wonder, what do you think her absence means in terms of enthusiasm, in terms of viewership as we head into the playoffs?
Well, the good thing is that the WNBA has sustained a measure of that growth from last year. It isn't, you know, 2x attendance or TV viewership like they saw in 2024, but the league has experienced its highest attendance since 2002, almost 11,000 people per game, which is significant considering a few teams don't even play in stadiums that seat 11,000 people. They've also experienced a decent chunk of growth in their national TV games. ABC reported that they had 13% year-over-year growth from 2024 to 2025. And again, not all of those were Clark games, but the WNBA is in a period where you would hope for like the hyper growth that you saw in 2024. And this is more of a measured growth heading into the postseason and what figures to be a very pivotal offseason as the Players Association negotiates a new collective bargaining agreement with the league as a whole.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. If I remember correctly, the current collective bargaining agreement expires at the end of October, and we've just heard so many players being vocal all season about what they want. Do you think that Caitlin Clark's absence and the potential impact it may have on viewership changes the scope of those conversations at all?
Well, if you think about the major sources of revenue for a sports league, broadcast rights is a big part of that, and the WNBA is entering a 11-year, $2.2 billion broadcast rights deal with ESPN and, you know, a couple other big partners that starts in 2026. And there's a look-in option on that deal that allows them to reevaluate within 3 years. And part of the metrics that, you know, would decide if the broadcast partners are willing to pay more is if they have higher postseason ratings. Because we saw last season that even as the regular season was dramatically popular in 2024, once Caitlin and Indiana were eliminated in the playoffs, the postseason had a lot more measured ratings. And so I think the WNBA was hoping to put up a really big number with the Fever and, you know, their most popular star in this year's postseason. So that would have been a nice carrot for the players to head into negotiations with. But I still think that the players have a lot on their side in terms of the revenue and sponsorship and attendance and all of these metrics working in their favor. It just would have been nice to have one more item in their bag when they come to the table.
Sabrina Merchant covers women's basketball for The Athletic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bishop Michael Pham leads the Diocese of San Diego, and maybe his most visible act as the leader of Catholics in a city on the southern border of the U.S. is his presence at immigration courts. In the hallways, in the courtrooms themselves, he says it is important to be there physically with people facing deportation.
That's what they need, and knowing that we can't do much of anything, but just the fact that being present, they're so happy and grateful that we were there.
Our conversation with Bishop Michael Pham this weekend on All Things Considered. Listen on your radio or ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name.
NPR News.
It is 529, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op in Bemidji, partnering with local farms for over two decades to provide fresh and local foods, promoting sustainability through local buying. Open daily from 8 to 8, more at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For
for KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Hundreds of Iron Rangers packed into the Iron Trail Motors Event Center in Virginia on Wednesday. They were there for a chance to comment on the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's new wastewater permits for Keetac. Megan Buffington attended and has more.
The PCA had to open up additional space for the 400 miners, environmentalists, and politicians. The presentation, Q&A, and comments swam through the complex history of the state's wild rice sulfate standard and its enforcement, and what that means for Keetac Mine and the Iron Range now and into the future. Here's the simple version. Minnesota law limits sulfate to 10 parts per million in water to protect wild rice. That's even lower than the drinking water standard. For various reasons, that limit hasn't really been enforced in the 50 years it has existed. The PCA says Keetac has until April 2030 to comply with the limit. U.S. Steel asked for a variance, but the PCA denied it. The PCA used a lottery system to decide who got to comment at the meeting. About 40 people got to speak of the over 150 who signed up. If you had to split it, about 60% were Iron Rangers who opposed the PCA decision. Most expressed fear of the economic repercussions and questioned the basis of the standard. Chad Daniels has worked in the mines for almost 30 years.
This standard isn't right. At some point we'll get it right and we'll comply with it. It'll make sense. But are we going to put these companies and these jobs out of business and get rid of them? And it's too late at that point.
U.S. Steel estimates it will cost the mine hundreds of millions of dollars to meet the standard, which the PCA agrees with. And Keetac's only the first mine that will have to do so. It doesn't help that hundreds of miners are currently laid off and U.S. Steel is being sold. The other 40% of speakers were environmental and indigenous advocates who say the enforcement of the rule is long overdue. Mike Maleska is a retired miner from Hibbing.
The company doesn't want to pick up the tab. Instead, they want you to raise your voices to pressure the MPCA to eliminate the only water quality standard we have so they can continue to pollute, setting the stage for even worse desecration of our rivers and lakes for our kids to deal with.
The draft permit and variance decision are open for public comment through September 22nd. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
With a new school year here, roughly 150,000 Minnesota K-12 students are receiving special education services. Districts are mandated to craft learning plans for kids with disabilities, but for parents, requests can sometimes involve a maze of phone calls, documents, and meetings. State data show growth in families asking for support, like individualized education programs. The demand comes amid greater awareness of neurological disorders, including autism. Advocates say after a diagnosis, parents encounter a process where school staff want to ensure the child's needs meet certain criteria before an IEP is put in place. The Pacer Center's Beth James assists families in these situations.
That line is not super clear. And so that's what makes it really difficult because it's so highly individualized. However, a student does have to demonstrate educational need in order to be eligible for those special education services.
That means the school has to see evidence of the disability affecting a student's learning. If staff says the time isn't right for an IEP, parents have options, including an evaluation done by the school. If there's no resolution, they can seek a formal conference with the district and possible mediation facilitated by the state. Pacer encourages parents to connect with an advocate, get everything in writing, and if successful, prepare to have their plan reviewed each year. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will host a public meeting as part of its corridor study along Highways 2 and 169 in Grand Rapids. The proposed alternative that will be discussed at the meeting Wednesday includes replacing several traffic signals with roundabouts and proposing a three-lane model for the corridor. The meeting will begin at 5 p.m. at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, morning show, and Phenology teams. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing the number 27-MEDICARE. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Something unusual is happening behind closed doors here in Washington, D.C. People who serve on grand juries are rejecting the government's arguments. NPR's Carrie Johnson explains.
Over the past month, grand juries in D.C. have refused to indict defendants at least seven times. That almost never happens because prosecutors exercise near total control over grand jury proceedings. Robert Sindrich is a retired federal judge in Pennsylvania.
Keep in mind that only the prosecutor is in the room. The only evidence the jury hears is that which the prosecution gives them.
And the grand jury needs to find only probable cause that a person broke the law, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Kevin Flynn prosecuted violent crime and homicide cases in D.C. starting in 1987.
So I was in the office for 35 years, and a friend of mine was in the office for 25 years, so a combined 60 years of experience. We compared notes last week. He never had a case no-billed by the grand jury, and I just had one.
Flynn says the rejections by grand juries today represent a failure of prosecutorial discretion. Prosecutors can charge virtually any crime that comes to their attention, but they usually make judgments about how to use their resources, decisions at the start about which cases to drop and which to charge in a process called papering.
I understand that the U.S. attorney has ordered the prosecutors in that office to paper every single case that the police bring in, which, by the way, is prima facie asinine.
Grand juries operate in secret. Professor Paul Butler at Georgetown Law Center says there are a couple reasons why they may be resisting.
Either the jurors thought that the prosecutors hadn't proven even the low standard of probable cause, or it could be that they're more bothered by what the government did than what the defendant is accused of doing.
These grand jury rejections started happening around the time President Trump surged federal agents and National Guard troops to the city. Take the case of Sean Charles Dunn, the former Justice Department worker accused of throwing a Subway sandwich at a federal immigration officer. He got charged with felony assault of a law enforcement officer, which carries up to 8 years in prison. The grand jury wasn't buying it. Again, Paul Butler.
That crime requires that the prosecutor prove an intent to kill or seriously harm from a sandwich being thrown at you. Come on.
Dunn will not get off scot-free. He now faces a misdemeanor charge, which carries up to a year in jail. In recent days, he's become a symbol of resistance in the district. Posters of Dunn chucking a sub sandwich have cropped up across the city. During the morning rush on 14th Street this week, people stopped to peer at the street art, but they didn't want to share their last names for fear of reprisal. Ashley, who's lived in D.C. more than 8 years, counted herself a fan.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a great reminder that, small acts of rebellion can help.
Jackie stopped to look on our way to the grocery store. She's lived in D.C. for 60 years, and she does not think the National Guard presence here is necessary. But she says acting out against police is not the answer.
I don't think policemen deserve that. You know, say what you want to say about them, but I don't think we should mistreat them.
U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro told NPR in a statement that, quote, the system here is broken on many levels. Pirro says juries have been politicized, refusing to indict people accused of making threats against President Trump, and, in Pirro's view, refusing to abide by their oath to follow the law. Retired Judge Sindrich says from the outside, it appears the justice system is working the way it should.
The citizen in the end, in the American system of justice, is the final arbiter.
Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Do you like to dance in the mornings? Because a new party trend starts early and it's fueled by caffeine. One of these parties in Seattle is creating community among the Latino population there. From member station KNKX in Seattle, Frenny Menares reports.
There's about 150 people packed into this coffee shop in Seattle. They're dancing to reggaeton with drinks in hand, iced coffees, matchas, and lattes. It's all happening around noon with sunshine streaming through the windows. Videos and photos of this monthly event have made the rounds on social media, bringing more partygoers. And this party's over by 2 p.m., giving people like Patty Montesi time to do other things. At 42, Montesi says she's in her señora era, so drinking and staying up really late don't fit her lifestyle anymore.
Yeah, I'm going to go grocery shopping, go home, shower, take a nap, and then I'm going out tonight with some friends.
An event like Cafeton provides a space to sing out loud in Spanish and helps people like Montesi feel connected to their roots.
I'm Latina, and I don't have enough Latino-ness in my life in Seattle.
The Seattle area is predominantly white, with 11% of the population identifying as Hispanic or Latino. This midday party is among many transforming coffee shops into day clubs in cities like D.C., Austin, Texas, and Los Angeles. In Chicago, event promoter Jordan Williams created a similar dance party called Cafeton. It got so big, he rented a venue to hold more people. William says around 5,000 people showed up.
The demand kept coming. Like, I was even impressed. I'll be honest. Like, I was impressed. I was like, oh my gosh, like, people are obsessed with this.
It's a good combo, he says. Coffee shops are inviting. Caffeine hypes people up. Reggaeton makes them move. Plus, a recent survey shows the percentage of Americans who drink alcohol has fallen to a new low. And William says they're trying to find new social spaces.
A lot of people are in a phase right now of social curiosity. So really just being curious to getting outside, meeting new people.
Most people back at the party in Seattle are women. Some are wearing dresses and heels. Others are in gym clothes and running shoes. The space warms up quick, so people fan themselves while they twerk and twirl. Eventually, iced coffees are swapped for iced waters. Miriam De Leon is among the caffeinated dancers. She says this party draws direct connections between Seattle and Latinos.
I think it kind of marries the two, you know, because coffee is also really big in the Latin communities. So I think it's a familiar sense of a little cafecito, a little bit of music, and a lot of celebration and good times.
That familiarity is what DJ Leia York wanted when she created Cafeton earlier this year. She immigrated to the U.S. from Ecuador 3 years ago and says the people who come to Cafeton are like family.
That means the world, especially like coming to a country where I didn't have like any relative nearby, you know, like just have my husband. But now I think that I am creating a community where I feel like at home.
York says Latinos need a place to celebrate and find community right now as the Trump administration's immigration enforcement actions have caused anxiety.
You know, like with the current situation of like our community, people are worried, people are scared. So they found like Cafeton as like a place to forget problems, to just have fun, to connect with your culture.
Most people at the Seattle party danced the entire 3 hours. When the music stopped, the crowd chanted otra over and over again because they wanted more. For NPR News, I'm Freddy Monades in Seattle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The Republican tax and spending law will cut Medicaid by almost $1 trillion in the coming years, and states are already planning how to run leaner Medicaid operations. Lawmakers in about a dozen states may have another problem. They passed laws preventing them from using state dollars for their Medicaid expansion program. That includes North Carolina. As Nick Della Canale from member station WFAE reports, these states don't have a lot of options if they want to keep health insurance for their citizens.
It's the end of the workday at a community health clinic in Henderson, North Carolina.
Bye, have a good night.
Staff file out as a receptionist locks up. Dr. Laura Uchik hangs around an exam room, reviewing her patient notes.
Tons of diabetes today, some acute stuff.
She also saw migrant workers and a patient with substance use disorder, all typical cases for this town of 15,000 just south of the Virginia border. Ever since North Carolina expanded Medicaid 2 years ago, she says more of her patients can finally afford care.
They get Medicaid and we're like, let's go. You know, they're the best visits.
She says people with substance use disorder can now get shots that curb cravings. Patients with diabetes can afford insulin and glucose monitors. Across North Carolina, nearly 680,000 people now have health insurance that's at risk under the Republican tax and spending law. That's because North Carolina is one of 12 states with some kind of trigger clause. It means if the state pays anything to insure these people from the general state budget, the entire program will end. It's why North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis voted against the bill in June and said President Trump pledged not to touch Medicaid.
What do I tell 663,000 people in 2 years or 3 years when President Trump breaks his promise by pushing them off of Medicaid?
Right now, the federal government pays 90% of the insurance cost. The rest of the money in North Carolina comes from a special tax on hospitals and medical providers. But the federal Medicaid changes require that states cut that special tax on hospitals by nearly half. That means North Carolina needs to fill that gap if it wants to make sure low-income residents have insurance. Lawmakers could just change the trigger law and use state dollars.
I don't know that we're looking to eliminate the trigger law, so that's not the path that I think we're headed down.
That's Jay Ludlam, Deputy Secretary of North Carolina Medicaid. He says there's also the new work requirements to get Medicaid in the tax and spending law. States have to set up an administrative apparatus to run that by January 1st, 2027. He says it's not clear how North Carolina can pay for it without state dollars.
But it really needs to move in earnest over the next couple of months in order to meet incredibly aggressive deadlines and timelines.
For now, North Carolina medical providers say they don't know what to expect.
We're very much in a wait and see, you know, what is going to actually happen. No idea.
Tim Evans is CEO of Mountain Community Health Partnership in Mitchell and Yancey counties, areas hard hit by Hurricane Helene. He says the possibility of fewer patients having health insurance in a couple of years is like another storm on the horizon.
We didn't know that the storm would be coming from Washington as much as from Helene.
But at least this is one storm states can see coming, and they can buy themselves some time. The tax and spending law does allow them to ask for extensions in implementing the work requirements. For NPR News, I'm Nick Della Canale in Charlotte, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Ripple River Gallery, south of Deerwood, hosts the dual exhibit Reclaimed Reframed, now through September 28th, featuring sculptures from KAXE's own John Bauer, paired with photographs from Rachel Kane. The exhibit proves that one person's trash is another person's treasure. Open Wednesday through Saturday from 10 to 5 and Sundays 11 to 4. We receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork, with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC. Kutaska Community Action hosts a Big View Conversation Tuesday, September 9th from 11 to 1 at Community Presbyterian Church in Grand Rapids. This month, learn about First Call for Help, whose mission is to provide crisis intervention and referral services. Pre-registration required. Email alicem@kutaska.org. Support comes from AW Research Laboratories in Brainerd, reminding private well owners to test their drinking water annually. Common well contaminants such as bacteria, nitrates, and arsenic are odorless, tasteless, and colorless. More information and test kits available at awlab.com. The Virginia Public Library offers a genealogy assistance program the second Thursday of the month at 4 p.m. Whether you're just starting out or fine-tuning your research, all are welcome. Mixed Precipitation Opera and Theater Group presents Pickup Truck Opera Volume 5, Saturday, September 13th at 3 p.m. at the Mask and Rose Theater in Popovsky. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. A scary movie opening this weekend is part of a wildly successful franchise.
There's something horrible happening in my house. Could you come and take a look?
The first film in the Conjuring series came out in 2013. It is about a haunted house. Now the Conjuring universe is worth more than $2 billion worldwide, with 9 films that include spin-offs, like one about a possessed doll named Annabelle. It is the most lucrative horror movie franchise in history, and as NPR's Netta Ulaby tells us, the whole thing is based on a controversial real-life couple.
The newest movie is called The Conjuring: Last Rites.
The devil has come to Pennsylvania.
It's based on real people who believed their house was haunted.
Jack and Janet Smurl claim that an evil presence has found its way into their home.
In the mid-1980s, Jack and Janet Smurl told the media that a demon was abusing their family, including 4 young daughters, that it hurt a family pet, that it sexually assaulted them. In the movie, the family is helped by a pair of professional Ghostbusters named Ed and Lorraine Warren.
So, when did this start?
The Warrens were also real people who have since passed on. Here's the film's director, Michael Shobbs.
Obviously, in our movie, you know, the Warrens are heroes. They do their best to save the day.
But not everyone thinks of the Warrens as heroes.
They have always been entertainers.
Grady Hendrix is a best-selling author of horror novels. He has long studied the occult in popular culture. Ed and Lorraine Warren, he says, started crafting their public image in the early 1970s, after the huge successes of the Exorcist novel and movie.
They started saying that they were demonologists and that they were experts and that they had seen secret church files about all the exorcisms in America.
Exorcisms, they're a big part of the Conjuring movies.
By the power of our Lord Jesus Christ!
The Catholic Church had gone through Vatican II when it liberalized in the 60s, and there were a lot of sort of old school Catholics, Ed was one, who felt like the church had gotten too liberal and it needed to get back to its more conservative roots and really embrace the idea that there is a Satan who's attacking people.
But the Conjuring movies are based on real people with terribly sad backstories, says Grady Hendrix. Substance abuse, other forms of abuse, generational trauma, mental health crises.
These are cases where people are in distress. And I don't think it helps to have a couple of people who have no training and no clinical background show up, tell you it's a demon, and walk away with book and movie contracts.
Take one case that became a book, a made-for-TV movie, and the 2021 movie, The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It.
It's July 18th, 1981. This is Ed Warren. Here with Lorraine.
It's about another real family whose preteen son saw visions of monsters, quoted from the Bible, and hissed at people, according to media interviews with his parents.
And his family had recently seen The Exorcist on TV. His sister had gone to a lecture by the Warrens beforehand. They decided he was possessed.
And his sister's boyfriend invited the demon to come into him. Later, Hendrix says, the boyfriend murdered his landlord and served 5 years in prison.
But the Warrens showed up to say no. He's not guilty by reason of demonic possession, which the judge very rightly threw out right away.
Eventually, 2 family members sued Lorraine Warren, claiming the family had been exploited and manipulated.
Which was a frivolous lawsuit, to be honest with you. It was very frivolous.
And it was dismissed, says Tony Spera. He represents the estate of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Spera married their daughter, Judy, and now runs a society for psychic research the Warrens started. Spera says he's used to people criticizing the movies and the Warrens.
They never knew them. They're armchair quarterbacks. They're trying to say that these cases were phony, they're fraudulent, they're not real. It's not meant to be a documentary. It's not meant to be a word-for-word transcribing of what happened.
Still, director Michael Shobbs says he struggled with the ethics.
During Conjuring 3, I really struggled with it.
Shobbs directed that movie and the new one. For The Conjuring: Last Rites, he says he worked closely with the 4 now adult sisters who were all minors when their parents said their house was haunted.
You know, it really left big scars on their family and on them as individuals. And I guess one of the things that really struck me was just how much the Warrens meant to them. When so many people were very skeptical, the Warrens came in and the Warrens believed.
Shobbs says he believes the Warrens too. Grady Hendrix is not so sure.
Look, I write horror for a living. I'm a sucker for a ghost story the same as anyone else.
Matt Hendricks says what really haunts him are people with untreated mental health issues, children who may have been abused, and people who harmed others, whose problems were solved on screen with exorcisms, and whose real stories were told as entertainment. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Anyone who has ever traveled with kids knows it can be a lot. There's the stress of getting through security and that oh-so-lovely rush of anxiety you get as you struggle to fold your stroller while keeping an eye on your little one. Well, now there may be some hope for traveling families. The Transportation Security Administration is rolling out the Families on the Fly program. Marion Summerall with Central Florida Public Media checked out these new family-friendly lanes.
Pockets empty.
With a baby on her back and two children clinging to her legs, Emily Manley is approaching the security checkpoint line at Orlando International Airport.
I've got three of these are mine.
They're on their way to Oregon and are directed to the family lane, a new concept from the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA.
They told us way down, they're like, walk right over there and there's a family-friendly line, and they were super sweet to all the kids.
She is relieved that there aren't too many other people around rushing to get through security to catch their flights. That way, her kids don't get separated from her.
The other ones I've gone through are like, they're like, you know, holding them back, like physically as I go through, so we don't go through at the same time, which is scary for kids.
In fact, TSA says it will not separate children from guardians in these lanes and has modified screening procedures it says limits pat-downs.
You're an expert there. You had a lot.
Pete Garcia is helping some families arrange their bins. He's TSA's security director here.
You see the number of strollers, small children, and we want to be able to provide them as much assistance as we can and get them through here as effectively and efficiently as we can.
Garcia says there's just more patience and help for families with small children.
A lot of times they may be in a standard lane, you know, mixed in there with business travelers and other folks, and they may feel like they're a burden.
But not in this lane. And Emily Manley can calmly gather all her kids and her belongings after passing through the TSA checkpoint.
It's so nice. I love anything that's like geared towards families because you don't find it often.
Besides Orlando, at least 10 other airports, including Oklahoma City, Tampa, Salt Lake City, and Charlotte, have rolled out family-friendly security lanes, and TSA says more are in the works.
Have a safe flight.
For NPR News, I'm Marion Summerall in Orlando.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From RBC Wealth Management, dedicated to providing financial strategies to help navigate wealth planning and legacy building. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd and 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Looking at weather tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 37 to 42, northwest winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, Grand Rapids Riverfest Day, partly sunny, highs 57 to 60, northwest winds 5 to 10.